This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Treasures in the Dark, 90 Reflections on Finding Bright Hope Hidden in the Hurting, written and narrated by Catherine Wolfe, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Greetings, folks. My name is Dr. Jamar Tisby, and welcome to another episode of Footnotes. Every episode is special, but this one, this is why we have the podcast. It is near and dear to my heart as a historian, as someone who lives in the Delta, as someone who's working for racial justice. My guest today has been an editor, a journalist, founding member of the National Association of Black Journalists. He has taught in many different capacities. He has also been the field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Mississippi in the Civil Rights Movement. Charlie Cobb, welcome to Footnotes.
Well, thank you, and I am happy to be here.
I'm honored because I live in the Delta. I study your work. And folks like you give me inspiration. Just to give you your flowers, I know people have recognized your contributions and your achievement and your very being, but I just want to add to that and say that real people like you, working diligently, wisely, persistently for justice, are building a legacy. We're going to talk about SNCC Legacy Project. You're building a legacy. I'm a recipient. This is one of the highest honors that I have in this podcast is to talk to folks like you. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, thank you for listening or being here yourself.
Absolutely. Well, this is going to be fun. I get to introduce some of my listeners to you and your work. Many of them wouldn't know what the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee is or was. How would you describe it to someone who's kind of new to it?
Well, we were an organization of organizers, basically, to put it in one sentence. And we grew into organizers out of the eruption of student protests, basically coming off HBCUs in 1960. This is a very specific date, in fact. February 1, 1960, four students from North Carolina A&T, a black school in Greensboro, North Carolina, walked into a Woolworth, did a little shopping, sat down at the lunch counter in the store, and tried to get some, I think, donuts, coffee, soft drink, something like that, things students would get, cheap and tasty, and were refused service. And they sat there until the store closed. And of course, in a town like Greensboro or on a campus like A&T, the word spread. And the next day, more students came. And the next day, more students came, occupying every seat at the lunch counter. Meanwhile, word is spreading to other HBCUs. And within a couple of months, there were sit-ins in which is what they were called, in about 80 southern cities, challenging segregation. Out of that grew SNCC. Ella Baker, a critical figure, both in the larger expanse of southern history that goes beyond SNCC, before SNCC, and after SNCC. Ella Baker, a North Carolina native, you know, who was then the temporary executive director of Martin Luther King's SCLC, immediately recognized the significance of this student protest and convened a meeting. She got $500 from Martin Luther King to convene a meeting at her alma mater, which was in Raleigh, North Carolina, Shaw College, then Shaw University now, and to bring the students together because nobody knew anybody. I mean, you would hear about Atlanta students sitting in or Nashville students sitting in or Orangeburg students, but nobody actually. And she thought the students should meet and sent out a letter, you know, inviting students to gather. She was expecting about 100. I think a couple of hundred showed up. And out of this, Martin Luther King, I should mention, gave the money for this conference because he was looking for a student wing. of his organization, SCLC. But Ms. Baker was going around and suggested, well, maybe you want to think about founding your own organization. And out of this grew SNCC. And the first thing Ms. Baker said to this body of students was, what you're doing is about more than a hamburger and a Coke.
I remember that, yes.
And she began talking about the necessity to really, and it was not something on the students' minds, really. Remember, this is a student protest that's unfolding. And she's raising, at that very first meeting, the necessity of digging into communities and organizing.
Mm.
And SNCC is formed around, still around protest, but that idea stays with SNCC, and the discussion is continuing pretty soon. And this is all happening. The students' sit-ins broke out on February 1, 1960. And this is all, and the student gathering was April 1960.
Oh, that's fast.
And yeah. The second meeting that led to the actual formal establishment of SNCC happens in October 1960. So this is happening all within that, the year 1960.
Wow.
And pretty soon, and that same year, and here I wouldn't want to be held to the date, the first student. The students decide, in order to do this, you have to be more than a student. Hmm. You have to commit full time, at least for a little while.
Wow.
And the first of these students to commit to doing that, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago, is Charlie Sherrod.
Sherrod, yeah.
A Virginia student. He drops out of school. He's in divinity school. And pretty soon you have a small core of students leaving school, planning to do this. It was nobody was talking about making this a career.
Mm.
You know, nobody was talking about this as a lifetime effort. But yeah, you can drop out of school for a semester or two semesters, that kind of thing, to begin to explore what Ms. Baker is suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
Digging into communities and organizing at the grassroots. And that's what begins to happen. And that thus begins a slow transition among the students that now are part of SNCC. And there's more to this. It's a complex issue. I recommend Clay Carson's book on SNCC.
Yeah.
And who gets into the actual history, or Wesley Hogan's book on SNCC gets in there. But basically, there's a slow transition from protesters, you know, sitting in and all of that, which is not to disparage sitting in and all that, but a slow transition from protesters to grassroots community organizers, learning how to dig into communities, not to build SNCC chapters.
Mm.
You know, but learning how to dig and encourage people to begin to organize for change.
Yeah.
Because you could tell in all these little communities, and SNCC also does something very significant. It decides to do this in the rural Black Belt South, which has largely been ignored by mainstream civil rights organizations, because those organizations, without naming them, but they were mainstream, felt that doing this kind of thing was too dangerous and you got too little result for the kind of danger that doing this involved. So you had, especially NAACP chapters, you had a lot. And Ms. Baker in the 1940s had been the NAACP's director of Southern branches. So she had organized all of these local branches across the South, and they felt ignored. And it helped us, because to go into these little bitty places and say you were one of Ella Baker's people gave you serious credentials, because she was, although she wasn't in the newspapers or anything like that, she was maybe in the rural Black Belt South one of the most highly regarded people.
Absolutely.
You were one of Miss Baker's people. It meant, and she was Miss Baker to us because she was 57 years old when she made her way to us. And remember, I'm 19 years old when I go to Mississippi. So, so she, and the way we had been raised,
she's definitely Miss Baker.
You were There was no Ella. She was not right. Ella to us. She was Miss Baker. and she gave us a lot of introductions to these communities. And it was clear almost immediately that among the leadership in these rural communities, the thing that they felt most important was not getting a hamburger at a lunch counter, but voting rights. You know, there was a clear consensus here. You want to do something? And Amzie Moore, who was really important to us getting into Mississippi, made it clear to us. He was not interested in organizing sit-ins in his little bitty town, Cleveland, Mississippi.
Yes,
I don't think it had 5,000 people in it. He was not interested in having sit-ins. What he saw looking at the sit-ins, and he told me this later, years later, that what he saw looking at the sit-in was student energy.
Mm.
And he wanted to use that student energy to get what he thought was important. And what he thought was important was voter registration.
He
made us welcome, and he was one of the first grown-ups I met in Mississippi. So that's a very compressed version of a story that we could take 3 or 4 hours elaborating on. And that relates to how I wound up in Mississippi.
So that's a wonderful explanation. I really appreciate how you talked about Ella Baker and than a hamburger. She talked about strong people don't need strong leaders.
Strong leaders. And
really animated the ethos of SNCC. And I'm curious then how you get involved. Was there a conversation, an event, a light bulb moment that made you say, okay, I got to drop what I'm doing as a 19-year-old and get involved with this protest movement?
Not exactly. It's more complicated. I was a Howard University student in 1961. Mm-hmm. So I became involved in the sit-in movement. Howard had a student organization, NAG, the Nonviolent Action Group. Stokely Carmichael comes out of that. A whole bunch of people come out of that. And we were sitting in Maryland and Virginia, which were completely segregated. Because I was involved in the sit-ins there, CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, invited me to a workshop in Houston, Texas, for student activists. And I decided to go because I got this bus ticket. I think CORE gave me a little money. And the bus went Washington, D.C., Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. And my thinking then was, well, it'd be an opportunity to see the whole South just getting from Washington, D.C. to Houston, Texas. And I got off the bus in Jackson, Mississippi. And there's a real lesson in this because the students were sitting in. And, you know, we think in many ways of our generation, me, a 19-year-old, as the Emmett Till generation. We all remember the picture in Jet magazine, or The Jet, as we used to call it, Emmett Till's body. His mother had insisted on an open casket so she could. So Mississippi was wholly defined to us by the murder of Emmett Till. And we were on either side of his age. He was 14. You were either 15 or 16 in 1955 when he was killed. So it was hard for me to imagine. I felt it was one thing for me to be sitting in Maryland and Virginia, but surely something qualitatively different for students in Mississippi to be sitting in. Maybe they had some kind of gene or something like that I didn't know about, some kind of courage gene, if you will, because it was, in our way of thinking, the most worst place in the universe for Black people, and I wanted to meet them. So I made my way to their headquarters. The NAACP had a local office there, and they gave me directions to the student movement, Mississippi student movement, and I introduced myself. Pretty much as I'm talking to you, I said, well, I'm involved in the sit-ins, and I'm a Howard student. I'm involved in the sit-ins on the way to this workshop in Texas, and I just wanted to meet you and get a sense of what you all were doing. And one of these students I'm talking to, Lawrence Guyot, who's passed away now, but he was then a Tougaloo student, just graduating from Tougaloo College in Mississippi, and was getting ready to go up and work with SNCC in the Mississippi Delta. And he gets up when I say this, and Giat was a big guy, 6 feet, a couple hundred pounds, and almost bullying in his tones. And when he responded to me, and I remember the words exactly, because you remember the words in these kinds of situations almost exactly. He said, "You're going to Texas for a workshop on civil rights? What's the point of that when you're standing right here in Mississippi?" And then another one of these students, Jesse Harris, who has also passed away now, chimes in. He says, "Yeah, man, you're in the war zone here." And so they're coming at me.
No better.
What you going to do? You going to talk or you going to do something? And that's an important piece of civil rights struggle that is often overlooked. As much as the movement is defined by challenges to racism and white supremacy and segregation, perhaps more importantly, the movement is better described as the challenges Black people made to one another within the Black community. Because I worked with Mrs. Hamer for a while, and if you travel with Mrs. Hamer, what she's doing is challenging people when she's moving around. She's saying, "Look at me, Mrs. Hamer had a third grade education. She was been a sharecropper all of her life on cotton plantation, and she was 46 years old. And basically, she was telling people, challenging people. She says, 'If I can do this, then you got no excuse yourself.'"
Yes.
You know, and that was the challenge that she was making. And it's not too far from the way Giat and the people in that student movement headquarters were challenging me. "We're doing stuff. We're getting ready to do stuff." And they were just beginning their project in the Delta. And I decided it was summertime after all. I didn't have to be in school. I didn't have to go to the conference. I would stick with them and see what they were doing. That was my response to what Giat and them were saying.
So you decided not to go to Texas. I'm going to stay here in Mississippi.
I'm going to see what they're doing.
This is going to be the best workshop I can get right now.
Yeah, exactly. So I go up there with them and I wind up in Sunflower County. That's where I meet Mrs. Hamer. She and join the effort at gaining the right to vote up there in Ruleville.
Yep.
And I'm there all summer. And then at the end, what I hadn't realized was once you do something like that and you're asking people to register to vote, they're putting their lives in danger. They are putting their work at danger because Mrs. Hamer was kicked off the plantation for trying. And I was with her the first time she tried to register to vote.
Whoa.
And she was kicked off.
You were at the courthouse with her?
Yeah, I was at the courthouse. We went down with 19 people, and Mrs. Hamer was one of them. She was just an ordinary person. She didn't stand out until everybody is scared, right? And we couldn't say to them, "We can protect you." We had nothing to offer them to that if violence happened. We were going, the courthouse in Sunflower County where we were was the birth where the White Citizens Council was born. Indianola, right. Mississippi. So you're going into the heartland of the White Citizens Council. Everybody's scared on the bus. None of the SNCC people could say, "Well, we can protect you," or whatever. Then from Mrs. Hamer starts singing from her seat in the bus. You know, she has this powerful voice, and she's singing. She's singing these kind of both church songs and kind of movement songs. "This Little Light of Mine," or something. You know, she's singing these songs, and just through the sheer power of her voice, not any words from the SNCC field secretary, the sheer power of her voice, she shored up those people. And whatever she gave them through her singing strengthened them. And I remember that vividly. It's one of my most vivid earliest memories of working in Mississippi, right? And so I still haven't left Mississippi for Washington, back to Washington. So at the end of the summer, this is in August of 1962, I realized, I couldn't just say, well, folks, it's been interesting, but I have to register for classes or whatever. I couldn't do that. I'm not made up that way. You know, all these
months.
These people have put their lives at risk. Wow. They put their work at risk. So I stayed. And that stay wound up being almost 5 years.
I was supposed to be here for 2 years. It's been almost 20.
So I stayed, you know, and I worked up. I basically worked in the Delta. There were a few times I left the state to do some other things for SNCC, but I stayed working right through Lyndon Johnson and the Congress passing the right to vote. And then I felt, well, maybe I can get back to my other life.
Sure. Voting rights. They passed the law.
And that's happening all of us. I mean, we're all between, I think the youngest person, June Johnson, who's passed, was 15 years old. But all of us are barely out of our teens and barely into our 20s. And we're involved in Alabama and Mississippi and Arkansas, where you are now, in the Arkansas Delta, where you are now, and Georgia and Virginia, and these places in the Black Belt, essentially, and trying to organize people basically to take control of their own lives. And that's not something we can do for them. They have to decide they want to control their own lives. If they want to do that, we were prepared to help them.
Yeah. You made that really important point that what is remarkable about the movement is really what was happening within the Black community.
Yes.
Black people challenging one another. Can you talk more about that? What was the challenge Black folks made to one another?
Well, part of it is what is driving this is fear. I don't think people today have a meaningful sense of how violent the Black Belt South was. This is not simply making a political decision to register to vote or something. This is making a decision that may put your life in danger or your family in danger or your livelihood at risk, particularly if you're a sharecropper working on a cotton plantation or picking tobacco or sugarcane or any of these crops that require a and people have to make up their minds that they're going to do this. And the way they make up their mind, of course, is not simply listening to Charlie Cobb, but also by talking to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you get them to talk to one another, this is the organizing mission, is you embed yourself in their lives. And you sit down with the ladies and watch the soap opera. And you go to church with them and you eat dinner with them. And we weren't staying at hotels. We were staying in people's homes. Here's a story that illustrates that. The first person I stayed with, in fact, family I stayed with, the McDonald's, Joe and Rebecca McDonald. Now, Mr. McDonald was 76 years old. And there had been shootings. And two girls had gotten wounded. And the mayor of this little bitty town, Ruleville, arrested me for doing it.
Oh.
Right? He said it was a publicity stunt, and we were failing in this voter registration effort, and I had orchestrated this shooting that resulted in these two girls getting killed to generate publicity. And he hands me over to the town constable, who's the brother of the man, as it happens, that killed Emmett Till.
Oh, goodness.
But he was the town constable in this little town, Ruleville, which had about 1,000 people in it. And I'm hauled off to jail, right? But this is all just an attempt to intimidate. And he lets me go the next morning, literally kicks me out of the jail, the little 3-room jail. I never will forget it. And the cells, I was worried because the cells opened out onto the street. So somebody could walk up to the cell and either speak to you or shoot you.
What?
This is the rural Black Belt, right? So he kicks me out of jail because the whole thing was bogus. right?
Of course. So, is that your first time in jail? First time getting arrested?
In Mississippi, yeah. Not my first time in jail. So I go back to the house, and it turns out that the constable, Milam, has confiscated the rifle of the man I'm staying with, the family I'm staying with.
Wow.
Mr. McDonald, or Mr. Joe, as we called him. He'd taken his rifle. And this is a problem because he had me and two other Snickfield secretaries staying in his house with his wife. And he used to go out every morning hunting to put food on the table.
Sure.
And without his rifle, he can't do that. He also used his rifle. He would sit on the back porch and shoot varmints attacking his little garden back there. You know, this is southern rural life.
Part of the culture.
And so I tell him, and this is where, you know, people decide for themselves. You can help them by giving them information. So I tell him, he's worried about his gun. So I tell him, well, you have a right to your gun, Mr. Joe. And he asked me if I'm sure. And as it happened, we had a book with us that had copy of the U.S. Constitution in it.
Oh.
So I get the book, I open it up, and I turn to the Second Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. I read it out loud to him. I said, and Matt, Charles McLaurin, was with us. He tells Mr. Joe, he says, you see, it's right here in the United States Constitution. You have a right to your gun. And then Mr. Joe tells me to fold over the page where we had just read to him and takes the book from me. Now, I forget about this, but then we realize a couple hours later that Mr. Joe is nowhere around. So we ask his wife, Rebecca. He says, well, where is Mr. Joe? And she tells us, well, he went to get his gun. You said it was all right. Now, the last thing I need is to have somebody get killed because he's gone down to City Hall to demand his gun back. Yeah. So we were getting ready to run after him, and we hear his old raggedy truck pulling up. And we race out to the truck, and we say, you went down to City Hall. And I said, Joe, what happened? And he says, I told the mayor. This is a little town, so you can walk into these places. And he says, I told the mayor I come to get my gun. And we say, well, what happened? He says, I didn't have the right to my gun. And then he tells us, but I brought the book. And I opened it up and I told him, it says right here that I have a right to my gun. And sure enough, the mayor gave him the gun back.
Whoa.
I remember him because he steps out of the truck and he's holding his rifle with his big grin on his face. So that's the kind of balance the organizer has or the people you're working with in the community, right? I mean, he trusts. Because the thing to understand about Mr. Joe with his 76-year-old, he was 76-year-old and couldn't read and write. So everything he said was based on his trust that what I told him was in the book. Well, if the mayor had asked him down there to read it to him, he couldn't have done it.
That's why you had to fold the page. Absolutely. And the level of responsibility that you all felt, because as these folks are taking a stand for voting rights, for their own gun rights or whatever, they are putting themselves in harm's way.
Yes.
In so many different ways.
They are trusting you as the organizer, but you are trusting that with the information, they'll make the right decision.
Okay.
That's what's going on. It's a relationship that can only happen if you've dug into the community deeply enough for people like Mr. Joe who would accept. There are lots of stories like this across the Black Belt at different – Stokely liked to tell the story of bringing a group down to register to vote. This is in Lowndes County, Alabama.
All right.
And this old lady, she's getting ready to go in to register to vote. And she turns to him and she pulls a Stokely said, a rusty old Civil War-looking pistol – out of her pocketbook and says, "Son, you better hold this for me because I'm going in there to try and register to vote." So there's lots of stories that what they illustrate is that it's possible to dig into these communities in a way that people really do trust you, because in some ways they're putting their lives in their belief that what you're telling them or encouraging them to do is legitimate. And that just does not happen overnight. Mississippi, I was unusual in Mississippi because I came from Washington, D.C. Most of the people, young people my age in the movement, were native Mississippians.
Oh.
There were only three of us. We had 23 people in the state in 1963. And only myself, Bob Moses, and Frank Smith. Frank came over from Morehouse College. That's it. Everybody else was native to the state. So in some ways, they had more at risk than I did. I mean, you know, nobody was going to bomb my parents' home in Washington, D.C. I just didn't run that risk. But the young people with me, they had Annie Moody, who's passed, but who wrote the book Coming of Age in Mississippi, talks about her worry about and what happened to her family. She chose to work. She chose to work on the other side of the state from where she grew up. She was still worried about what would happen. And there was harassment of her family in Wilkerson County, which is in southwest Mississippi. And she was working in Canton, which is sort of in the center.
And I'm so glad you're talking about what the risk is, because a couple of things that I think we need to hear today as we continue to try to work toward justice is, one, count the cost. Like, this is not light work. There is risk involved. And even though the risks today may be different than, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it is costly, and it's always going to be costly.
And the process is the same.
Yeah.
Okay. You try and embed yourself in a community. It's certainly different. I mean, I'm working in the rural South, and I can tell you anything you need to know about organizing in the rural South, but that's different than the west side of Chicago or south central LA. Yeah. So there are differences, and the level of violence, except for the police, is greater than. I mean, we had to worry about the Ku Klux Klan spy organizations like the State Sovereignty Commission and stuff like that. And that's not a worry today, but there are different things that are
vicious
and worrying.
And so far we've talked a lot about that physical violence, whether, you know, the ability to keep, I mean, black folks had guns, first of all, part of the rural South culture. And then secondly, because it was survival. And you wrote a book, I love the title, "That Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed." And it's so interesting. You're working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right? The movement even today is remembered largely as a nonviolent one. Can you talk to us about the role of nonviolence in these protests and whether what I'm asking.
Nonviolence, I know what you're asking. Nonviolence more or less works if you're having a sit-in, which generally is going to be in a city, because these little rural towns didn't have Woolworth lunch counters and stuff like that. So once you're in the rural black belt, the whole question of nonviolence really becomes moot. It really doesn't exist, you know, in these little towns. And anyway, and the culture, black or white, is an armed culture. You know, guns are everywhere. I never stayed in a house that didn't have a shotgun in the corner or a Winchester on the wall or a pistol on the – that's just the culture. It's been that way for 100 years before we even got there after the Civil War. That's the way it was. And you're not going to argue against that in any effective way. And the title of this book, I did, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, which is subtitled How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible, comes from a farmer, a black farmer. He met, and this is in early 1964, he met Martin Luther King, who was touring Mississippi. And of course, Hartman Turnbull was his name. And Hartman, if you talk to anybody involved in the Mississippi movement, Hartman Turnbull was a legendary figure. There's several legendary figures. He doesn't make it into the public consciousness the way, say, Mrs. Hamer does. But he was a legendary figure in Mississippi. And after the courtesies of greeting, he looked at Reverend King, because Mr. Turnbull was not known to bite his tongue. He said, and I quote him exactly, Reverend King, this nonviolence stuff ain't no good. It'll get you killed. And that was just too, it was just too long for a title. So I just shortened it to This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. But he was right. And he was worried that King was going to get killed. King was a hero.
Yeah.
But he was absolutely right. And that's where that title comes. And I always tell people I have to give my props to Mr. Turnbull.
There you go.
You know, because that was not something Charlie Cobb created. That came out of the mouth of a Mississippi farm owner.
Who knew exactly what the white power structure was capable of.
Yeah. So, in a lot of ways, I'll tell you another story. Unita Blackwell, another legendary figure. Yeah. In Mississippi's movie, Issaquena County, Mississippi. And she was the leader. And there's a whole story to be told about women and leadership in Mississippi. But Unita is one who illustrates women in leadership. And she was organizing for voting rights and the like. But I noticed her husband had never gone down to the county courthouse to try and register to vote. So I asked him, one day I said, well, how come your wife is the leader of the movement here in Issaquena County? So how come you, as far as I know, have never gone down to try and register to vote? He said, look, Charlie, if I go down to that county courthouse, I'm not going without my pistol. And if one of these white people, I won't use the word he used, but mess with me, I'm going to shoot him. He said, I know that's going to cause you some problems, so it's best that I not go. So that probably is more typical of discussions about nonviolence and violence and self-defense than some philosophical discussion about Gandhi and all that. It just, that's not the way conversations went.
It was much more
in the rural South. It was very pragmatic, and everybody was, you weren't going to argue against it. Everybody was in agreement that you had the right to defend yourself. Nobody was going to argue. Even the white people accepted that. So somebody if Knight Riders come to your farm, and there's lots of stories, and some of which I put in that book you just cited. There's lots of stories about that. I only know one person who was ever sent to jail for, and he was another legend, C.O. Chin. C.O. Chin, he was the first black guy I ever saw wearing a pistol and a holster strapped around his waist.
Open carry.
And that's how I had never seen that before. And when the Knight Riders, and he ran a nightclub in this town, Canton. He did bootleg whiskey. He had women and he was kind of an outlaw to start with, but he supported the movement. He supported, and as far as he was concerned, his mission was to protect movement people. That's what he was going to do. And nobody messed with C.O. Chin, even the sheriff. They got in a fist fight one day, the sheriff and C.O. Chin. But anyway, when he went to jail, because when the Knight Riders attacked his house, he drove him away with his rifle. And then when they fled, got in his car and chased them. And chased them to the Ku Klux Klan hangout, this gas station.
Whoa.
And still shot that up.
Whoa.
And he was sent to jail for that.
That's a bad man.
Yes, he was. Nobody messed with CO. And and these are all people, remember, our parents' age. These are not – all these people engaged in the gunplay were either the age of our parents or our grandparents. And I remember Janie Brewer making Molotov cocktails in her kitchen sink, and she was in her 80s. To drive away. So there's a – I tell a lot of that story in this.
So it's nonviolent in terms of its public demonstrations.
Yeah, those make sense. Those make sense. And you can choose. See, where we were in Mississippi, you didn't have any choice. The Klan or somebody shoots up your house. You don't really have any choice about what to – if people come to where you're staying and shoot it up. Or and the people you're staying with fire back. At a lunch counter sit-in, you do have choices. You can choose to sit in, and you if you know that and you know there's going to be violence, and you can choose, knowing there's going to be violence, to respond with nonviolence, or not participating in the sit-in. At all, because you know shooting it out at a Woolworth lunch counter isn't going to – this is just a practical decision. That's not going to solve anything. So you could choose to do that or not choose to do that. Howard, most of the students weren't sitting in.
Sure.
They may have been sympathetic, but they weren't sitting in. They weren't making that kind of choice. But if you're working in Mississippi or Alabama, these places, and Klan shows up – and opens fire. What you know? That's not the result of. That's not the result of something you're doing exactly. That's just because you're present in the county. And they want to. And they learn that they. And also they learn that violence won't drive you away. So they turn their violence toward the people you're working with in the community.
That's right.
And they make the choices about what to do. Or not doing. Most of the time, they chose to defend themselves, and they had rifles and weapons with which to defend themselves.
That makes sense.
The Deacons for Defense and Justice in Louisiana.
I was thinking about that.
And there were other groups not as prominent as the Deacons, but those are not decisions we made. You know, those are not decisions we made. We didn't organize the Deacons. CORE, which was really working in Louisiana, didn't make the decision to organize the Deacons. In Tuscaloosa, Alabama, there's a group of armed men, a secret group. They had no name. They had interesting rules. They had no name. You had to be a Christian, church-going Christian.
Oh, wow.
And you couldn't drink alcohol. Because they thought your tongue would get loose if you drank alcohol. They had these very strict rules. And their job, their mission was to protect the people who were working with Reverend King.
And that's what
they were going to do. Because Tuscaloosa, I don't know whether you know the story of Arthur and Lucy, who integrated the University of Alabama in the 50s. But Tuscaloosa was a notorious Ku Klux Klan town. But these guys, they were basically Korean War veterans.
Ooh, okay.
Trained. You know, like Robert Williams' group up in North Carolina. This was another one of the – there were these groups around the South. Most of which don't make it into the pages of that's the real history. they don't make it into the history books the way they should, particularly war veterans. World War I veterans, World War II veterans, and Korean War veterans were an important piece of how communities were protected. Not SNCC field secretaries, not Corps field secretaries. No, these guys, the ages of our parents and grandparents, uncles. And
what you're doing is revising our understanding of the movement in helpful ways. I love it when you quote Julian Bond. he's talking about... let me see what he say. He said, Rosa sat down.
Oh, Martin, yeah.
Martin, and then the white folks saw the light and saved the day.
Yeah, that was Julian. That was just when I was beginning this book, and I was talking to Julian about what I intended to do. I don't think I put a word down on paper. And somehow the conversation came up about history and how people understood the civil rights struggle. And he said, well, the average person, what the average person understands can be boiled down to three sentences is what he said. He says, Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, and then the white folks saw the light and saved the day. That was Julian.
Look at that. The white folks saved the day. Okay. Yeah.
I would add another one. And okay. If I had to add a fourth sentence, it would be in 1966, Stokely Carmichael shouted out "Black Power" and betrayed the movement.
Ooh.
That's the fourth sentence.
I gotta ask you to expound on that, because I think what you're getting at is we see the civil rights movement as heroic because it was nonviolent. It was, you know, suits and
love and redemptive suffering and
redemptive suffering, all of that, beloved community. And then we look at the Black Power movement as this sharp left turn into radicalism and violence and whatever. So how would you correct that misunderstanding?
Well, it just wasn't that. I mean, Black Power was what the movement had always been about. When Amzie Moore wanted Sick to come to Mississippi and we slept at his house, what he was interested in was using student energy to gain Black Power for Black people. And the way he saw doing that was through the vote. The numbers were there. His little county was two-thirds Black, and only a handful of Black people were registered to vote. So his vision was Black Power. We, in fact, weren't even thinking much about it until we got involved with Amzie and E.W. Steptoe. There were a whole lot of people we got involved with down on the ground in Mississippi. So Black Power was not a SNCC idea or a Stokely Carmichael idea. This was the people's idea. They knew they had the numbers to acquire real, meaningful power. The question was how those numbers can be organized.
Yeah.
How those numbers can affect the system that they're everybody's living under. And the most obvious thing to tackle is the denial of the right to vote. If you want to. So that's one mistake people make in the renown. Two, if you read Stokely, there's not a lot of calls for armed resistance on his part or anybody else. There is a story about self-defense and arms, but it doesn't exist in the South. There is a discussion to be had about the Black Panther Party that emerged in Oakland, California, and why they were armed.
Yeah.
That's not the discussion. That's a discussion out above the Mason and Dixon line. Okay. So violence isn't really meaningfully in the Black Power discussion as it emerged in the South.
It was about pride, self-determination.
Yeah, I was going to say pride is a part of it because you can't. It's not just acquiring the right to vote. It's also acquiring a different kind of sense of yourself. That's because what the system does is try and make you believe in your own inferiority. And if you believe in your own inferiority, you'll never acquire the kind of power that you need to have a meaningful life. And so that's embedded in the call. There's a whole discussion to be had about Black Power, and some of it we have on the SNCC website. Yes. But they were, it's funny, you know, I look at the, I've seen more times than I can count the footage of Stokely in Mississippi when he first, his finger is pointing like this and he's shouting out. And that's what terrified them, that it was no longer the loving, redemptive kind of thing, say, that John Lewis has or had. It's not that. Stokely is angry. He had just been released from jail. Stokely is angry. A lot of the SNCC people are frustrated because they
–
I wasn't at that particular moment. No, I was in another part of Mississippi. I was in the state. And, you know, there was a lot of anger and frustration, partly because by this time – remember, we're talking 1966. So many of us have been working for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And you could see now – that what we were up against was something more complicated and more powerful than we had realized initially.
Sure.
You know, and we were struggling to find a way to address that. I don't think we did a very good job in coming up with answers, but we recognized that there's something much larger that we were up against and we needed to figure out. And part of Stokely's call for Black Power was an effort to articulate how to deal with this system, which was not just a Mississippi system or a Southern system, this system that really reduced our humanity, in fact.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's where the discussion should be. But even the Black leaders felt that Stokely's call threatened them, you know, partly because it threatened their relationships with these white people who gave them money, or these political people who gave them political support. And then there's these SNCC people. Jim Foreman's book, you can get a real sense of that. In Jim Foreman's book, The Making of Black Revolutionaries, Jim Foreman was the executive director of SNCC, and he has in it really minutes from a 1964 meeting between SNCC people, NAACP people, and a National Council of Church, Council of Churches people, and maybe a couple of others.
Yeah.
And they're all beating up on the SNCC people about their language and posture. And DeVita, and I remember at one point, somebody, I forget who, talks about the work at the grassroots and that they don't need to be talking to the SNCC people. They need to be talking to these farmers in Mississippi. And one of the officials from an NAACP official says, I don't need to be talking to these farmers. What do they got to say? You know, and you got a real sense of the attitude.
Yeah.
This is in the post-Black Power articulation by Stokely. So in some ways it's a class issue. I mean, you know, I remember, I'll tell you one story about that comes from Mrs. Hamer.
Come on. Yes, please.
In 1964, you know, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenged the legitimacy of the all-white Mississippi delegation to the Democratic Party's National Convention. And ultimately, they're offered a compromise, which the MFDP rejects. They're offered, I think they're offered 2 seats, no votes, but sort of observer status. You could have 2 people who would, and the NSFDP, as Ms. Hamer said once, I didn't come up here for no 2 seats. And but anyway, afterward, Adam Clayton Powell, then the congressman from Harlan, comes up to Mrs. Hamer to criticize her and the decision of the MFDP in rejecting these seats. And then he kind of ends his criticism by saying, and do you know who I am? Ms. Okay. Hamer, in classic Mrs. Hamer style, says, I know who you are. You're Adam Clayton Powell. the congressman from Harlem. And then she goes on, classic Mrs. Hammer, she says, but I want to know how many bales of cotton have you picked? And shut him right down.
You see,
that's part of the tension there.
Wow.
This is before Stokely shouts out
Black power.
But those tensions are, those need to be explored more than the history does.
You know,
it's not the whole story, tensions, and because there were people, say, within the NAACP who really supported SNCC and appreciated what SNCC was doing. So people are.
But it's a lot more complex than.
Yeah, they're a lot more complicated than Stokely, the bad guy, and Diane Nash, the good woman of nonviolence and redemptive suffering. You know, it's a lot more complicated. And these are human beings. People forget you're talking about human beings here.
Yeah,
you know, and trying to grapple with this whole system.
Studying history. This is why I love talking to folks like you, because you were there. You can tell us, you know, more accurately what it was like. Mm-hmm. Now I'm wondering, you know, in terms of reflecting, as we record this, it is election day for midterms 2022. My goodness, mm-hmm. And. I don't know. What wisdom do you have for this moment? We got a lot
about wisdom.
Okay. Yeah. Think from your experience, because, you know, people are afraid. We are losing, if not already lost, our democracy. The same voting rights you were protesting for in the 1960s are under threat today. I mean, give us some perspective.
Well, yes, there's lots of ground. In some ways, these are unprecedented times. Partly because you have a former president, and I'll spare you the history of his presidency and just confine myself to his post-presidency life. We have a former president, Donald Trump, in an unprecedented way in the entire history of the United States, with the possible exception, with some differences, of the debates in Congress leading up to the Civil War. In an unprecedented way, has incurred violence, who has attacked the very institutions that, despite their shortcomings, have really facilitated democracy in this country. I'm not saying that everything that preceded Donald Trump was perfect or anything like that, but his attacks, both on the characters and the rules, is unprecedented. There's been nothing like this in American history. And I'm uncertain about where this is going to come out. Mm-hmm. Congress is cowardly. A lot of the leadership, political leadership, certainly on the Republican side. But I have another level of criticism of media and how they enabled Trump and people like him.
Sure.
I'm not certain how any of this is going to come out. I think of the post-Nazi government in Germany. And something like this, I think, was going on in Germany as well, that ultimately led to the emergence of Hitler as dictator and ruler of Germany, the Nazi Party. Trump has managed to cultivate a core group of people who feel that if democracy means the meaningful participation of Black and Brown people, I don't want it. I mean, he's cultivated a core group.
And it doesn't take about that.
Yeah, and I you know, in my reporting life, I was a foreign affairs reporter. Mm-hmm. And I've been in the middle of coup d'etats. I've been in the middle of takeovers of governments. And I know what the signs are. I know that you don't need a majority to sabotage a government. And I'd be dishonest if I didn't say that's my experience as a reporter, my reading of history, and I'm not a trained historian, causes me worry about what I see in the United States. On the other hand, there's a level at which I'm optimistic. I spend a lot of time with the movement for Black Lives, young people, the millennials.
Okay.
And I've talked to them. My next book is going to be about them.
Oh, great.
And I like a lot of what I hear. And they're struggling themselves to figure out, like we did, what to do beyond protests. They're very good at mobilizing for protests. Mm. Not so certain about how you organize.
Right, long term.
In communities. Yeah. You know, and here age both helps and harms us. I could say my age says that nothing that's important gets done in a hurry. Because here I am at my age. I'm, I'm there twice the age of some of these young people. I could say it's not like struggle disappears. You know, it's, you know, just the way we leaned on older people like Ella Baker and the like, you know, feel free to lean on us for whatever. That's part of what the SNCC Legacy Project is about. Feel free to lean on us. And we're not interested in running your organizations. But if you need to know something about our experience that you think will help you with your experience, we're here. We're not hiding.
That's
and we're not reluctant.
That's good.
To talk to you. You need to know that there's at least one group of people out here.
And I've got to pick you up on that, especially on the mic, because I want this to get to as many people, but also just for me personally, this has been soul filling. But it's really just the beginning of a conversation. And so SNCC Digital Gateway.
Yeah,
y'all are that's doing incredible work.
Yeah, but that evolved. See, it was born at our 50th anniversary. We had a conference on the 50th anniversary of the founding of SNCC. And one of the things that emerged from that was the SNCC Legacy Project. Mm-hmm. And our idea was that we needed to get together to figure out how to convey our history. And within the context of our history, the larger movement history. That's what we had a discussion about. We had no idea about how we might do that, but that's what we felt was important. And that led to a variety of things. The first digital experiment that we did was around voting rights. And we had worked out a relationship with Duke University, partly because we knew the historian. So Tim Tyson was then there. Mm-hmm. Wesley Hogan was running the Center for Documentary Studies. There was a whole set of people, maybe because the university is a Southern school, and we had been interacting there in terms of their needs as historians for the most part. And that led to a formal relationship. By formal, I mean memorandums of understanding and all of this. Mm. We sat around the table pre-COVID. We sat around the table. And this was 10 years ago. Sat around the table discussing how to approach history, where Duke might fit. We were lucky in that respect of having a set of scholars. And we decided to expand the group. We invited scholars from Emily Crosby, who's a native Mississippian, but is up at upstate New York, I forget, Geneseo, something like some school up there. We invited Hassan Kwame Jeffries, who's out in Ohio, but he had done a really important book on Lowndes County, Alabama. So we expanded this, and we could meet. Duke put up the money for us to come together, stay in a hotel, and all of that. So we could meet, and we had these continuing discussions that eventually led to the SNCC Digital Gateway. Now, you can get to that via SNCC, S-N-C-C, legacyproject.org. And that will open up a homepage that also, there are three, provide entrances to three you can choose. One is the SNCC Digital Gateway, of course. The other is the CRIMVET site, the Bruce Hartford, he's in California, also has a site, Civil Rights Movement Veterans site. Mm-hmm. And then we have a Black Power Chronicles site. You can get to all of that via the SNCLegacy.org. But we began this 10 years ago. And now we're in discussion with some of the young activists today. We tell them, you don't have to wait till you're as old as we are. You need to do it because when other people write your history, yes, you're not going to like it. Yes. So the best thing to do is put your history out there. And we're doing an experimental project, again, via Duke. Which we'll have about three or four of these groups begin to document.
Oh, fantastic. And what their history. This is all free and available.
That was one of our insistence. We told Duke, if we do this using your campus, there can't be any barriers to accessing what we do. You know, no money, no password, either no passwords required, no money is required. All you have to be is interested.
Available on the web, and we'll put it in the show notes. My very last question for you, as we talk about the Legacy Project, as we talk about your experience, if you can articulate it, what do you hope your personal legacy as Charlie Cobb would be?
Oh, I don't think that way. So it's difficult for me to directly answer. What I hope, though, is in my way, little way, and I'm primary after a long career as a journalist for magazines and radio. I did a lot of NPR. I've been a reporter for WHUR Radio at Howard University. Okay. I've been a foreign affairs reporter at NPR. I did films for Frontline in its earliest days. And then I spent many years as a writer for National Geographic magazine. So, and I also helped found a news site, allafrica.com, which is now the largest source of day-to-day news about Africa. Amazing. It's not a site for essays. It's not. This is news. This is what is happening in this place, that place, and the other place in Africa. So I have this background in news and writing, and I'm still continuing. My life now is books. All right. So I hope that they will find in all of this work useful and clarifying information. Yes. About the world that they're living in today and what the possibilities are for the world they live in, will be living in tomorrow. I tell them all the time, here I'm talking about millennials. Uh-huh. I said, it's not like I'm going to be around for the next 100 years. You know, there's a finite, I have a finite existence, you know, so I'm trying to provide information that I hope they will find valuable. That's right, because I don't write academic stuff. I tell stories, and I'm trying to reach this younger generation. I'm not trying to impress whoever are the scholarly determiners.
Understood.
In this world, at universities or think tanks. I certainly want to be accurate. I certainly. Yeah. But I also have a view of the world, and part of my view is that younger people, the generation behind me, just the way Miss Baker taught us, or Amzie Moore taught us, or E.W. Steptoe taught us, and all the other people taught. Well, I want to do that in writing. You know, I tell them all the time. I say I'm not going to really be marching in protest with you all when you do that. Even if I said, I'm not going to do it. I'll be 80 in June. I was just telling some people.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations.
Yesterday. Yeah. I said, don't look for me to march on the Capitol. but I will support, if that's what you want to do, I will support it. Right. And I will share my experience.
And that is.
And that's enough for me. I don't worry about the rest of it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I don't want to leave any monument or. No, pick up a copy of my last book. I'd be happy.
Well, I can speak as a recipient of your writing and your sharing that it is a true gift. It really is. This time has been a true gift. You have, I have no doubt, stirred the hearts of some folks who have listened, and they're going to want you to come back.
Well, I'm always available. These days, in some ways, at some levels, I don't like this way of talking, but another way is convenient. I've probably talked to more people in more parts of the country via Zoom and other kinds of media. This way, sitting at my dining room table. I'm sitting at my dining room table because I just came from, I've been traveling for the last week. So
okay, my goodness.
So,
Well, I hope you get some rest after that travel. And again, thank you so much for all your work and contribution over so many long decades. Oh. This will be the first of many conversations, I hope.
I hope so, too. And I'm always available. You know, my telephone number and my email address
are not secret. Well, thank you, Mr. Charlie Cobb.
Okay,
and thank you for listening to this episode of Footnotes. We will catch you next time.